So here we go into the last part of our symposium on No to NATO, Yes to Peace. And we're going to start out the next panel with music. So Ben, again, is here, and he has a song that's called No More Sacrifice Zones. Please, Ben.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks to the whole organizing committee for this event. Won't say a whole lot about this song other than it was inspired by a book by Chris Hedges in 2012, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And there'll be a lot of opportunities to sing along. As they drove you from the plains, they're turning your homeland to a sacrifice zone. The company took the uranium, just the fallout remains. They're turning your homeland to a sacrifice zone, where your story's been forgotten. We will make it known. Sing that with me. We will make it known. We will make it known. Pine Ridge, you are not alone. Pine Ridge, you are not alone. Pine Ridge, you are not alone. Your homeland has been desecrated. Created. The next could be our own. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones. Together. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones. The state makes voting obsolete through emergency decrees. They're turning your city to a sacrifice zone. The cops occupy your street to bring you to your knees. They're turning your city to a sacrifice zone, where your story's been forgotten. Where your story's been forgotten, we will make it known. We will make it known. Ferguson, Ferguson, you are not alone. Your city has been subjugated. The next could be our own. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones. Coal men blew the mountain, killing everything nearby. They're turning your region to a sacrifice zone. The state refuses to help your people as you watch them die. They're turning your region to a sacrifice zone, where your story's been forgotten. Where your story's been forgotten, we will make it known. Appalachia, Appalachia, you are not alone. Your region has been desolated. The next could be our own. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones. The fighter jets will cut you down to push you all away. They're turning your nation to a sacrifice zone. The bombs that kill your children came from the USA. They're turning your nation to a sacrifice. nation has been decimated. The next could be our own. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones. Where your story's been forgotten, we will make it known. Pine Ridge, Ferguson, Appalachia, Yemen, Immokalee, Flint, Michigan, Northern Alberta, and Camden, Standing Rock, Navajo, Palestine, and Puerto Rico. We stand with you. You are not alone. Your lands and lives were sacrificed. The next will be our own. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones. No more sacrifice zones.
We are very privileged to have as the moderator of this next session, in addition to a number of amazing speakers, Joseph Gerson, who is the president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security, former vice president of the International Peace Bureau, co-chair of the Committee for a Sane U.S.-China Policy. Wouldn't that be nice? He was a co-founder of the No to War, No to NATO Network and the United for Peace and Justice Network. Jewish, he was steeped in the lessons of the Holocaust, has worked with leading Israelis and Palestinians for peaceful and just coexistence for 5 decades. He has opposed Israel's genocidal military response to the October 7th massacres, involved in launching the nuclear weapons freeze movement in the 80s. He is a leading advocate for nuclear weapons abolition, and his books include With Hiroshima Eyes, Atomic War, Nuclear Extortion, and Moral Imagination, Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World, and The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of U.S. Foreign Military Bases. Joseph Gerson.
Thank you for that very, very generous introduction. I want to begin with a celebration of Ben, who is really the shaman and teacher of our movement, who never fails to show up at a demonstration and to bring both spirit and lessons for us all. And as I was thinking about him singing just now, I was remembering my transformation when I went south in 66 to Appalachia and watching the destruction of that region on a very, you know, unbelievably destructive mode and racist as well. I was thinking about the changes that are going on here in the United States, right, to understand that we are in a profound crisis in which we face the possibility of a Trump dictatorship. We have a current president who says he's only accountable to God, and we have a Supreme Court which has just delivered us from some elements of constitutional democracy to a monarchy, a king. So says the dissenting opinion in the Supreme Court. So thinking about that, I found myself listening to Ben, thinking not only of Phil Oakes, whose spirit he keeps alive and brings to us, but I was also thinking about Victor Jara of Chile, remembering what happened to Victor Jara, and thinking that in time, as we go into the crisis that we're entering, we're going to need to be defending Ben. We're going to need to be defending our movements. We're going to need to be holding the banner of democracy high. And we're going to need to find the courage that African-American movements, women's movements, people in nonviolent resistance to the Nazis that I was privileged to work with, we're going to need to pull on all of that for the coming period. We need to understand just how serious the moment is. As we begin, I want to celebrate three people who are here. Alain Rouet, Ludo and Reiner, if you could stand up. I had the privilege of being with them in Strasbourg 15 years ago at the NATO summit, when, among other things, in terms of trying to understand the violence inherent to NATO, during a nonviolent rally that we were holding, 50,000 police had been mobilized to contain us, and they bombed us from helicopters with choking and tear gas. So just to appreciate the people who lie at the origin of this movement and to know that we're building on it, I also want to appreciate Joe Lombardo, who's here somewhere, who in 2012 helped to organize the protests against NATO in Chicago when it was meeting in Chicago. So we have that. Looking at my notes here, in theory, this session was about war preparations and bases, and we've already done a lot of that. And our speakers will be moving in some different directions, which I'll describe in a moment. But I want to hit on the question that was raised earlier about military bases and their impacts. 40 years ago this year, I was invited to Japan to the World Conference Against A&H Bombs. And in addition to engaging Hiroshima and the Hibakusha, I also learned for the first time that the United States had more than 100 military bases and installations in Japan. You could meet people who had come from Guam, who came with two maps. One was a map of where the best fishing water, the best drinking water, and the best agricultural land in Guam was. And the other map was of the U.S. bases in Guam. It was the same map. And so we need to understand quite what the implications are. A couple of years later, I was in, in Okinawa, and I was challenged by a young Filipino and a young guy from Fiji who said, if you're so concerned about military bases, you should write a book about it. And, you know, if you listen to young people and they're telling you the truth, you have to live with it, right? So in doing the research, you know, among other things about bases, you learn that land seizures are essential to them. The U.S. Consul General in Okinawa told me a few years ago that the entire island was a U.S. base. There's a profound history of military accidents, whether they're in the course of live fire examinations or drunken Marines. I once had to extend condolences to a family who had lost the mother and daughter from a drunken Marine. Crimes go hand in hand with foreign military bases, the present ones as well. You have environmental degradation, and Pat, who's here, can go into enormous detail about that for us. Sexual assaults. Militarism is militarism, right? You know, the history in Okinawa of the violation of women, sexual violence, rape. It's just been announced that there have been 5 more rapes of young Japanese women by U.S. Marines in the last little while. You have the loss of sovereignty by nations and communities that come with the bases. And not least is the preparation for and engagement complicity in war fighting, including preparations for nuclear war, which Ludo will be speaking about very shortly. I guess the last thing I want to say about bases, and I'll move to the introductions here, is to say that we just celebrated, Independence Day, the Declaration of Independence, which I think was actually signed on July the 3rd. But if you read the text, what you find that one of the reasons for declaring independence from Britain and for actually fighting a war was that King George kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies which committed abuses and usurpations. What was good for those rebels more than 200 years ago is good for the rest of the world now. Okay. So then, I guess one last thing to get here. There was an article in the New York Times just the other day, and it quotes the head of the Heritage Foundation. How many people read that? There's a critical thing in there where he says that with the Project 2025 of Trump, that we're moving toward, and not toward, but we're moving into the culmination of a second American Revolution. And this is not a revolution for democracy. We need to understand quite the depths of where we are and what their agenda is. And it's not one of peace and justice. As the sign says here, it's about, in large measure, both white supremacy and profit. So I want to, in introducing Ludo, just to say I've just been really privileged to know and work with Ludo a long time. As was mentioned before, based in Brussels, and with the values that he has, he in many ways has been an anchor for the counter-NATO movement for peace, and we're lucky to have him here. He's going to be focusing on one dimension of NATO that really has been little discussed so far, which is the fact that NATO is a nuclear alliance. It's preparing for the omnicidal nuclear war that will take us all. And the resistance, he'll be focusing on the resistance to that. Then we'll go to Tamara. She's a Canadian voice of Women for Peace, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Canada, the Global Network. She's on the advisory committee of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. She's been a central figure in the Global Women United Against NATO. She's a PhD candidate in global governance at the Basile School for International Affairs at Wilfrid Laurier University. She has a master's degree in international politics and security studies and has done research, among other places, at the University of Bradford. Then Anne Wright. How do you introduce Anne Wright? Right? So I found myself thinking that in some ways, she certainly brings to mind Daniel Ellsberg. She's been on the inside, and now she's out on the out. And it took a lot of courage to do that. And she, in really in the tradition of whistleblowers, is out there for us every day. Her style is a bit different from Dan's, but just to appreciate what a gift we have in the courage and vision and values that Anne has. She is indefatigable. To say just a few more details, I think in materials you've seen, and certainly on the website, there's a link to her article on RIMPAC, and she'll be speaking a fair bit about that in a moment. I'm privileged to say Anne is a member of the board of my organization, the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. She's a member of the advisory committee of the World Beyond War. She's based in Hawaii some of the time. Anne is a retired U.S. Army Reserve colonel and a 29-year veteran of the U.S. Army and Army Reserves. She was a diplomat, and catch this list, in Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Sierra Leone, Micronesia, Afghanistan, and Mongolia. She received the State Department's Award for Heroism in her actions during the Civil War in Sierra Leone. She resigned from the Department of State on March 19, 2003, in opposition to the Iraq War. She's the co-author of Dissent, Voices of Conscience, and appeared in the documentary Uncovered. We're really privileged to have this panel with us, and I'm going to give Ludo the floor first.
Thank you, Joseph, for the kind introduction of us all here. As Joseph said, dear friends and comrades, I want to talk about nuclear weapons. It's almost forgotten topic in public debate, and I will come back to that, but in the 80s, there were massive, massive demonstrations in Europe, and I think also in the US, opposing these weapons and asking the need of disarmament, nuclear disarmament. That's the peace sign, by the way. Not many people know that, but it's nuclear disarmament. It became more known during the Vietnam War, I think, but that's the original symbolic of the peace sign. So the war in Ukraine has brought nuclear weapons back into the spotlight. Unfortunately, a nuclear confrontation, according to the doomsday clock, is even more likely than during the Cold War. In my contribution, I would like to address NATO's nuclear policy and the concept of nuclear sharing, in which U.S. nuclear weapons stored at military bases of 5 European NATO countries, and maybe soon 6, play a central role. Only gradually, nuclear weapons became a central part of NATO's military post-Cold War strategy. In NATO's earliest years, nuclear weapons were in fact not even mentioned in the alliance's strategic concepts. Even when the U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe peaked at more than 7,000 in the 70s. Nuclear arms were considered a responsibility of NATO's nuclear powers. Only in 2010, at the NATO summit in Lisbon, NATO accepted a strategic concept proclaiming for the first time to be a nuclear alliance. So from the 50s, the U.S. began to deploy, so it's much older than the 2010 strategic concept, but from the 50s on, the U.S. began to deploy nuclear weapons in other NATO member states, giving them a role in the planning and preparation of nuclear war, with the establishment of the Nuclear Planning Group later in 66. And in the years that followed, all countries, new members included except France, became involved in the nuclear deterrent policy, which was increasingly defined as a form of alliance solidarity. The reason? International support among the population for nuclear disarmament grew. In the 80s, many hundreds of thousands demonstrated in European and US cities opposing new deployments of nuclear arms. The strengthening of humanitarian and anti-nuclear norms during and after the Cold War played a key role in pushing NATO to adapt. And this led to this collectivization of political responsibility over nuclear weapons. Why? First, nuclearization of NATO as an organizational identity allowed pro-nuclear actors to justify costly nuclear modernization programs and nuclear deployments as contributions to alliance solidarity and cohesion. Second, this nuclearization of NATO undercut the potential for intra-alliance resistance to nuclear arms. Calls for nuclear disarmament could be seen thus as anti-NATO. So that was the game. Nuclear sharing became a core component of NATO's strategy. Of the three nuclear powers in NATO, so France, the United Kingdom, and the United States, only the United States has nuclear arms in other member states. In my country, Belgium, in Germany, in Italy, the Netherlands, and Turkey. Once there have been also, and this is promising, it means that we can get rid of them, there were also US nuclear arms in Canada from 50 to 84, when I'm not mistaken, in Greece until 2001, and in the UK until 1992. And that could be probably the next, again, sixth country with nuclear US nuclear bombs in Lake and Heat. Currently, the US has an estimated 100 tactical B-61 bombs deployed in Europe. They have to be mounted into, and that's not in Turkey, dual-capable aircrafts in wartime. And each year, the nuclear sharing is exercised in steadfast noon maneuvers that until recently have been kept secret. There are several legal and political problems with NATO's nuclear policies. And I have four of them. First, no, many more, I think. First, the concept of nuclear sharing can be considered as a transfer of nuclear arms to non-nuclear states, which would be in breach with Article, and is in breach, with Article 1 and 2 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1970 already. The NPT prohibits the direct or indirect transfer or control of nuclear weapons to non-nuclear weapon states. And this would be certainly the case once the fighter jets of non-nuclear weapon states, the countries I just talked about, take the skies and with the permissive action links activated that allow the nuclear weapon to be used during a military operation or an all-open war. But according to the US, the NPT would be not valid anymore in wartime. Argument, the purpose of the NATO to avoid war failed. These bombs will soon be replaced by new B-61-12 bombs equipped with an electronic tail kit that can guide the bomb to its target. And they have also lower yield options. Actually, they combine several types of B-61s in one B-61-12 bomb. The mixture of both precision and lower yield options could be seen by war planners as more usable weapons. The new B-61-12 could increase the danger and will increase the danger of a war with nuclear weapons, eroding, by the way, the concept of deterrence. A second problem with NATO sharing's policy is nuclear sharing policy is that there is no transparency whatsoever around the presence of these nuclear weapons at European military bases. It makes democratic debates and decision-making virtually impossible, which is probably no coincidence. Traditionally, according to several surveys, a majority of the population in most NATO countries is in favor of a ban on nuclear weapons. Even if it's not clear if the war in Ukraine changed this public mood, the secrecy surrounding nuclear sharing is unacceptable in a democracy. A third problem is NATO's aggressive stance towards the nuclear ban treaty, the TPNW. At its latest summit in Vilnius, 2023, NATO reiterated that the non-proliferation treaty, remains the essential bulwark against the spread of nuclear weapons, claiming its strongest commitment, that's their words, to the full implementation of the NPT across its three pillars, including Article 6. On the other hand, NATO member states have been boycotting the negotiations on a treaty to ban nuclear arms, the TPNW, although it can be seen, or it is an implementation of the same Article 6 of the NPT, in which the parties commit to negotiate a treaty for complete nuclear disarmament. NATO has been waging disinformation campaigns with the false claim that the ban treaty undermines the nuclear disarmament regime and that it lacks control and verification mechanisms, although in Article 3 of the TPNW, it clearly states that non-nuclear weapon states shall, and I quote, maintain its International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards obligations at the minimum. So these are false claims of NATO. NATO sees the TPNW as a threat to its political unity over the nuclear strategy, and that's the real reason for the strong dismissive language in the Vilnius Declaration, calling the TPNW in opposition and inconsistent and incompatible with the alliance's nuclear deterrence policy. And again, at odds with the existing non-proliferation and disarmament architecture, causing risks undermining the NPT. In any case, the reactions and declarations of the US and NATO are expressions of concerns about the general impact of the TPNW and the wide support it receives, endangering its political cohesion. Therefore, the Vilnius Declaration emphasizes that talks and negotiations on disarmament should be done with NATO as a platform. In other words, NATO members are not supposed to initiate or participate in disarmament initiatives outside NATO or without the leadership of the US. The fourth problem is that NATO has always been ambiguous in its nuclear policy. It's paying lip service to the NPT while its nuclear powers continue to pour billions into replacing or upgrading their nuclear arsenals. I want to refer to the latest ICAN report that said that nuclear investments increased with, again, 10% and 35% the last 5 years, up to $91 billion. And more than half of it is by the U.S., two-thirds by NATO countries. NATO's statements are full of contradictions. According to the NATO, and now I quote from the Deterrence and Defense Posture Review of 2012, that was in Chicago, nuclear weapons are a core component of NATO's overall capabilities for deterrence and defense, alongside conventional and missile defense forces. NATO is committed to arms control, disarmament, and non-proliferation, but as long as nuclear weapons exist, it will remain a nuclear alliance. And this is the mantra they always and each time they repeat. The language NATO used in the Vilnius Declaration is not such as to invite Russia or China to disarm, blaming these countries for the erosion of the disarmament regime while it remains silent over its own role in it, like the deployment of a missile shield after the US pulled out of the ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the US withdrawal of the INF Treaty and Open Skies Treaty, the Iran deal, and so forth and so forth. And then also you have the whole delivery, future delivery of nuclear submarines to Australia, the AUKUS stuff, let's say. The challenge now for the peace movement is to convince other social movements that nuclear disarmament is not only a matter for peace organizations, it's a matter for all of us. It has already been said, I think, today that there are two planetary threats, climate change and the threat of nuclear war. Climate change is a complex thing because it's a systemic change you need nuclear, to avoid the threat of nuclear weapons, it's very simple. You need to sign the paper and to disarm. It's very simple to get rid of one of the threats. So we are all fighting for the same future, for the survival of humanity and the planet. So a wide social and political movement against the danger of nuclear war should be put forward with a number of, and it's just a number, a few examples, common demands. And I focus also on Europe now, because it's can be a first step towards nuclear disarmament. First of all, of course, we need full transparency on nuclear weapons in Europe to enable at least a democratic debate in the society and also on the decision-making level. Second, we don't need any more this kind of lip service, hypocritic lip service to nuclear disarmament, as NATO is doing all the time, but concrete disarmament initiatives leading to negotiations to avert the growing nuclear danger in Europe. And this can only be successful if there is a ceasefire in Ukraine, if international tensions are reduced and mutual security interests are taken into account. Then we have the good environment for nuclear disarmament. And three, new agreements are needed to avoid new nuclear weapon deployments in Europe on all sides. Once this is realized, the withdrawal of nuclear weapons from the territories of nuclear sharing countries can help shape conditions and commitments for a nuclear weapon-free zone in Western, Central, and Eastern Europe. And is this possible? Of course it's possible. It's a matter of political will to negotiate procedures, time frame, and verification mechanisms so we get rid of all nuclear weapons in Europe. And then four, a legal ban on nuclear weapons and accession to the DBNW. How difficult politically this seems to be, I believe there's always an opportunity to break the nuclear cohesion of NATO. And we have seen that with the participation of some of NATO countries in the meeting of state parties under the TPNW treaty. There were like two meeting of state parties. My own country, Belgium, took part after heavy pressure, nevertheless, from the United States, as well as Germany, the Netherlands, and other countries. I think Norway was also one of them. But last but not least, we must disband NATO to achieve a nuclear weapon-free world, I think. Ultimately, the true abbreviation of this militaristic war organization is a nuclear-armed terrorist organization. Thank you very much.
The Secretary General of the United Nations, Guterres, has warned us that we're living on the knife's edge. That's serious language. Bolton Atomic Scientist, 90 seconds from midnight. In conversations I was in within the last, 2 months with a former Russian general, he explained that more happened in 1983 when Soviet early warning systems went down. You know, we think that Colonel Petrov may have saved the world by his courageous decision not to pass the warning. But in fact, this general said that despite the fact that it was wrong, the warning went through to Andropov's nuclear suitcase. He was awakened. We came that close. And the Russians are saying, as we think about Ukraine, that if Crimea comes under threat, all bets are off in terms of possible Russian use of nuclear weapons. So it's urgent that we understand the moment. The last thing is a book to recommend to you. There's a new book, which I think we all need to read. It's a new book by Annie Jacobson called Nuclear War, A Scenario. Her initial trigger, I think, is misconceived. But nonetheless, drawing on deep knowledge of U.S. and international nuclear infrastructure and doctrines, she describes how we could end life on the planet in 72 minutes. We need to understand just how urgent the moment is. It's called Nuclear War, A Scenario. So let me introduce Anthony Rogers Wright. He's a prototypical New Yorker. He has over 12 years of experience as an environmental urban planner, researcher, policy analyst, political strategist, consultant and organizer. His professional experience has covered a broad range, including but not limited to corporate and nonprofit environmental consulting firms, grassroots political campaigns and healthcare advocacy and outreach. Most recently, Anthony focused on climate disruption, which is to say climate change mitigation strategies. He hasn't been doing the climate change at local and regional events. He is a staunch advocate and a student of environmental justice tactics and strategies, including tactics to bring environmental awareness and stewardship to low-wealth communities and communities of color to the mainstream environmental consciousness. His passion for economic justice has taken him as far away as Israel, where he had the opportunity to study the damages there. Maybe next week he'll go to Gaza to study them. And when not immersed in work, Anthony can be found teaching or taking yoga classes on stage or performing jazz funk guitar somewhere on the planet. So let me introduce a man of many talents and many commitments. Anthony, it's yours.
Thank you so much, everyone. Anthony Creeper Rogers Wright. It's really great to be here. So awesome to see so many amazing souls coming together for some truths that simply have to be told where we are right now. I won't be going to Gaza next week, Joseph, but oddly enough, I will be going to Budapest, Hungary at a very, very interesting time in Europe. And I'm not just talking about the feckless fossil-fueled war that's going on in Ukraine, but just in general. Of course, Viktor Orban, who is the prime minister of Hungary, has some very interesting takes on NATO, is not a big fan of NATO, and pretty much just off the entire European Union. And he just took over as president of the European Union in the rotating cycle. And one of his first acts decided to go to Moscow to visit President Putin to talk about a ceasefire and is being castigated for it by the United States government. Go figure. Well, let me get into what I'm going to speak about. I won't take too much time because the panel, I'm looking forward to the discussion. I think that what we know now not really so much to the help of too many mainstream environmental organizations who have not just put it plain that there is an axiomatic nexus between militarism and the climate crisis, right? You simply do not hear enough environmental organizations speaking about this, and it's unfortunate, right? And I'm going to give some examples of why that's unfortunate. So let's just talk about NATO, right? Everyone in here, I believe, knows that the biggest consumer of fossil fuels in the entire world is the United States military, and therefore the biggest emitter in the world is the single entity is the United States military. But that's just for some of their emissions. We don't even have a full scope on how much they're actually emitting, because keep in mind that militaries like the United States uses immense amount of data. There's a lot of data centers. Data centers use a S-ton. I'm in a church, so I'm going to be good today. You use a lot of energy and create a lot of emissions, right? That's why we see the Gates of the world and the Bezoses of the world attempting now to kind of portray themselves as climate champions because they know that they're biggest culprits of it. But the United States military, of course, uses a lot of data. But let's talk about NATO. NATO's overall military spending in 2023 was $1.34 trillion. It's hard not to laugh when you say a figure like that, right? You know, peace should not cost $1.34 trillion, right? War costs $1.34 trillion. Peace, it turns out, is better for the climate and also better for economies, but call me socialist, but that's just what I think. But this $1.34 trillion in 2023 produced an estimated 233 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalents, which is more than the combined emissions of Colombia and Qatar, okay? Now NATO is also, they are proposing a increase of $126 billion more to their budget, I guess, one point. Just can't find it with $1.34 trillion. You know, we need a little bit more, but 126, which will lead to an estimated 31 million metric tons more of carbon dioxide equivalents, which is the equivalent of about 6.7 million U.S. cars on the road. So many people heard in 2015, a lot of climate people left the city of Paris after spending a lot of money to get there and emitting a lot of emissions. This Paris Climate Agreement came about. I'm here to tell you that it's a sham. Anything that was sponsored by the fossil fuel industry is probably not a good climate agreement. But let's just say that is the baseline. The International Panel of Climate Change says that we are supposed to reduce 43% of global emissions by 2030 compared to 2019 levels. That's not going to happen, folks, because that would require an annual reduction of military emissions of at least 5%. NATO is increased in 2023 alone its emissions by 15%, and they're looking to increase even more emissions as this feckless, unnecessary fossil fuel war continues. And even though NATO's increase of military spending would pay for the minimal of climate financing, you may have heard of things like loss and damage. We like to call it a Black Alliance for Peace climate reparations, which governments are saying, we just can't find the money. We can't find the money. But NATO's total military spending in 2023 would pay for this financing 13 times over and provide levels of climate finance. I wouldn't say needed to address the climate crisis. I would say needed to survive it, right? We just have to be honest that unfortunately, what's in the atmosphere is baked in, and we are seeing consequences right now. You may have been outside today. For instance, it's 118 degrees in Las Vegas right now. It's not, and keeping in mind, it's not even the afternoon, right? They're still in the morning out there, and they're setting to break records. This all to say, and I'm gonna wrap up in a moment. As long as NATO continues, the emissions are going to continue. As long as these feckless wars continue, the emissions are going to continue. One of the best things that we could do for the planet, literally, is to disband NATO from just a sheer scientific perspective, right? And the irony for me is, and I want to say right now, for whoever's listening, I am not a Trump supporter. I am not at all. However, it is really, really interesting right now that you have a neoliberal so-called center-left party in the Democrats who are saying, we are the party of science, and the Republicans are the climate deniers. And here they are saying, no, we need more money for war, more money for NATO, more money to basically sable-rattle a nuclear power in the form of Russia and all of their allies. My comrade and one of my teachers who's in the audience, Rafiki, just told me today, for instance, that Turkey is looking to join BRICS, right? I'm with it too. So I mean, all to say that this is all possible, but don't believe any party whose standard bearer goes on ABC News with Stephanopoulos and says, no, the proof that I am an able president is that I'm handling two wars. And, you know, but this is also a man who wants to be known as a climate president. You cannot be a climate president in pro-war. That is impossible. That is just impossible. The last thing that I'll say is that there are some really unfortunate things also. When we're talking about carbon dioxide equivalents, that includes a very, very nasty fossil fuel known as methane found through fracking. That is what the military is emitting the most. Here's the issue with that. Methane, when it goes into the atmosphere in its first 20 years, is 80 times more heat trapping than carbon dioxide. So the military is literally, if there was a worse fossil fuel to emit other than coal, the military is doing that right now. We don't have 20 years for this to dissipate. Tipping points have already been broken and hard choices are going to have to be made. But I'm just going to read to you the other environmental impacts that we also have to consider, because these too often are invisible eyes. Emissions from consumption of petroleum products by the military actions. Emissions from firing of petroleum products. Apparently firing tanks, firing guns, it does produce emissions. Anyone who was bothered by the 4th of July and telling your dogs and cats everything is going to be okay, it wasn't just the sound, it was the smell of all that stuff as well. Imagine that like 100 times over from a whole bunch of guns and tanks. So we're not counting those emissions. We're also not counting emissions from fires of buildings after they get hit. They emit stuff. Buildings are made with really bad stuff like asbestos and other stuff you probably don't want to breathe in. We're not accounting for that. And then we're also not accounting from emissions from forest fires and the destruction of agricultural lands, which is a spoil of war, right? Destruction of forests. Forests, by the way, have trees. Trees, by the way, trap carbon dioxide. They are good things. We should be cutting military budgets, not cutting down trees. So that's all I'm going to say. I'm looking forward to this. Yeah, that's it. Think about all of this in November, but not just in November. And hopefully if I do make it back from Hungary, and I'm going to say, yeah, I agree with Viktor Orban, but I'm really looking forward to their perspectives and bringing that back and reporting back. So thanks, everybody.
So with that, I'm going to give the podium here to Tamara, who's going to give us a number of really excellent lessons.
Good afternoon, friends. It's really great to be with you all, to work together to delegitimize NATO, to work together to disband NATO, the most destructive force on the planet. So Anthony's presentation is a perfect segue to my presentation. First, I would like to bring greetings and solidarity from the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. This is an umbrella organization of approximately 45 peace and anti-war groups across the country. Over this next week, we have rallies taking place from coast to coast calling on Canada to withdraw from NATO. We also have a parliamentary petition calling on the federal government to withdraw from NATO. These are some members of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War with our signs. NATO harms the climate and environment. War is not green. NATO is a climate criminal. I am also bringing greetings from the Global Women United Against NATO. I am also part of that women's organization, and I want to encourage all the women out there to join us, to follow us on our new social media, No NATO Women. Go to our website, Women Against NATO, sign our declaration, and follow us online. So since NATO's war against the former Yugoslavia 25 years ago, NATO wars and military spending have exacerbated the climate crisis. NATO has delayed climate action. NATO is a threat to people and the planet. It is impossible for us to rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions with NATO's rising military spending and carbon-intensive militarism. In October of 2022, I was at the climate summit COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh with my sign, No to NATO, Yes to Peace and Cooperation. And in the opening plenary, I had the opportunity to listen to the Libyan president, Mohamed el-Memfi, talk about how difficult it is for his country now to deal with the severe climate impacts. Dust storms, sand storms, sea level rise, flooding, extreme heat having an impact on agriculture. And he said that Libya now does not have the socioeconomic capacity to deal with the climate crisis. And as you might recall, last September in Derna, there was catastrophic flooding in Libya, and they weren't able to cope with this. Libya is not resilient to deal with the climate-induced extreme weather events. And the reason why is because NATO destroyed Libya in 2011. It was Canada that led the NATO bombing of Libya in 2011. We bombed energy systems, water treatment plants. We have made it impossible for Libya, which was one of the wealthiest countries on the continent, to cope with the climate crisis. And now Libya continues to be in economic and political turmoil. Libya is in ruins. After I was in Egypt for the climate summit, I spent a month, a tour. I went from Egypt to Russia, Finland, Latvia, Poland, and Romania. I went to speak to people about the war in Ukraine, NATO expansion, how climate change is affecting these countries, and also opportunities for peace building. This is a map from NATO's eastern flank. And just have a look, friends, at all of the army installations and all of the naval assets that are in this region right on Russia's border. And over the past 2 years, NATO now has in place 50,000 troops that are at high alert, high readiness, ready for war. These are the air assets in the eastern flank along Russia's border, fighter jets and bombers are flying continuously up and down Russia's border. And think about all of the climate impacts from all of this militarism in the region. So when I was in Latvia, I went just outside of the capital of Riga to have a look at Camp Adazi. This is Canada's military base. Canada is leading a NATO multinational battle group there. And when I was there, I could hear the shooting and the shelling through the forest. It was very loud, the booms. And I stood outside the front gate with my sign, "No to NATO, Yes to Peace and Cooperation." I delivered a letter to the Canadian commander, said that, we don't support this. Every spring at this base, NATO conducts a tank warfare exercise called NATO Exercise Crystal Arrow. And just have a look at the soil compaction, the destruction of the forest. This is a satellite photo from Google Maps of Camp Adazi, and you can see the decimation of the forest. So Latvia has lost in a really important sink for its carbon emissions because of Canada's NATO battle group here at this military base. In August of 2022, for the very first time, a NATO Secretary General came to Canada's Arctic at Cambridge Bay and talked about Canada's Arctic, the homeland of the Inuit Indigenous people, as being NATO's northern flank. Canada is going to be spending $38.6 billion to massively militarize the North for NATO and for NORAD, the binational U.S.-NATO military alliance. We are not protecting the Arctic. We are militarizing it. So we have a new campaign in Canada, Stop the Militarization of the North. We stood outside the U.S. Embassy in Ottawa with our sign, "Canada out of NORAD, Canada out of NATO, make the Arctic a zone of peace." Do you know that this is what the Indigenous people, not just in the Canadian Arctic, but in all of the Arctic states have said, that the Arctic must be a zone of peace? So we need to support them in their effort. We need to protect the Indigenous people. We need to protect the Arctic because it is a fragile oceanic ecosystem that is really crucial to regulating the oceans and to regulating the climate. We need to cooperate with all the Arctic states, including Russia, which accounts for 50% of the Arctic Ocean. We need to cooperate with Russia. So I want to quickly give you a timeline about how NATO has started to emerge in this climate and security space. In 2021, NATO released its first climate change and security action plan, and that was the year that the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg first appeared at a climate summit, and that was COP26 in Glasgow that I was at, and I protested NATO there. And then in 2022, at the Madrid summit, in NATO's strategic concept, it mentioned climate change for the first time as a threat, but it's very low on the priority. The top threats, of course, for NATO are China and Russia. And at COP27 that year in Egypt, it was the German pavilion that hosted NATO's climate and security panel. In 2023, at the NATO summit in Vilnius, NATO released its second climate change and security plan. This is a compendium of best practices. And what NATO is conveying is that, in some ways, some of its militaries are greening some of the things that they are doing. They also launched an impact assessment and a new methodology for accounting for greenhouse gases. But it is only for the NATO headquarters, not for the NATO militaries. It is not dealing with any training or operations or tactical vehicles. This is the scam. And then that was the year in 2023 that Canada announced formally that it was going to establish NATO's new Center of Excellence for Climate Change and Security in Montreal, Quebec. This is a greenwashing exercise. Canada is no leader on climate or security. Canada has failed to meet every single target under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in the past 30 years. This is the picture of Canada with 11 other NATO members announcing this new Climate Change Security Center of Excellence. Now, you know, my assessment, of course, is that really since the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was established 30 years ago, it's NATO that has derailed the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement and impeding our ability to keep emissions to 1.5 degrees and meet the targets for 2030. NATO is operating outside of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change system. The mitigation that it's doing is very minimal. And, you know, it's continuing to invest in carbon-intensive militarism that is path-dependent, that is keeping us, for the next 30 years, using fossil fuels. Its reporting and its accounting is not transparent. It's not independently verified. NATO is now calling climate change a threat multiplier, but it's NATO that is a threat to the climate. Anthony was talking about NATO's military spending. In 2009, the NATO countries, which are, you know, the developed countries and that are the greatest emitters and the most responsible for the climate crisis, they made a commitment in 2009 to spend $100 billion for climate financing, for developing countries to adapt to the climate emergency. But they have not been able to find that $100 billion for climate finance. Where is it? But in the past 10 years, since 2014, since the Paris Agreement, NATO countries have increased their military spending collectively to over $200 billion annually, to, as Anthony said, $1.4 trillion. So at the climate summits, we have our signs, cut military spending for the green environmental facility, for loss and damage, for climate finance. This is absolutely crucial. I also bring to your attention this really important report from Tipping Points and Transnational Institute called Climate Crossfire, how NATO's 2% military spending targets are contributing to climate breakdown. It is so crucial for us, friends, to call for a cut to military spending for climate action and adaptation. Finally, I want to mention to you these two other reports. How many of you have read the synthesis report that came from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change last March? Has anybody read this 80-page summary report of the latest climate science? Friends, this report is very important. I urge you to read it, to get a copy, to print it out and bring it to your elected official. The other report that came out just last week was by the United Nations, its Sustainable Development Goals report. These lay out the commitments that the international community made for us to achieve by 2030. But we are not meeting these commitments because we are spending so much money on militarism and we are engaged in war instead. The IPCC report that I just mentioned has this really important chart in it. And what the scientists are saying, that with a very high to high confidence, in the next 70 years, global mean temperature rise will increase to 3 to 5 degrees. This is catastrophic warming. And this, they are very concerned about the habitability of some regions on the planet. So it is absolutely urgent for us to abolish NATO, to cut military spending so that we can save the planet and the climate and for our future generations. As well, in this IPCC report, the very final paragraph says, international cooperation is a critical enabler for achieving ambitious climate mitigation, adaptation, and resilience. International cooperation means we need to cooperate with all countries, Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, with all countries. The IPCC doesn't say anything about war and militarism, but it says international cooperation a dozen times. This other report that I mentioned, the Sustainable Development Report that was just released a week ago, in the launch at the press conference, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres made a very good speech, and he said, our failure to secure peace, to confront climate change, and to boost international finance is undermining development. First, we need action for peace. From Gaza to Sudan, Ukraine, and beyond, it's time to silence the guns, to support the displaced, and to pivot from spending on destruction and war to investing in people and peace. These two reports are really important. Make copies of them, bring them to your to the attention of your elected officials, and use them as really important levers. So what can we do? Well, we can't green NATO and war. We have to abolish it. And I'm long time in the climate and an environmental movement, and in the climate summits, we call for the big polluters, the big oil and gas companies, to be kicked out of the climate summits. We also need to kick out the big militarists. No NATO at COP. No NATO at COP. And then, friends, the other thing that we need to do, because our governments are failing us, they are not building peace. We needed to take it upon ourselves to build peace. I want to encourage you to go to Russia, to go to China, to go to Iran, and to make peace, to make friends. Refuse to accept this new Cold War. Refuse to accept it. You need to transcend it. I just want to tell you that at the last two climate summits, COP28 and COP27, the international civil society said that the United States was the greatest obstructor at the climate summits, and it received the Colossal Fossil Award. It was the greatest dishonor. We get so much negative media about China, but you need to know that China was lauded at the climate summits for being a constructive force, for bringing countries together, giving good, positive, constructive ideas for climate action. They used their panda diplomacy at their pavilion, lots of really great ideas, and they are the world leader on renewable energies, solar, high-speed rail. If we want to save the climate, we need to cooperate, and we need to cooperate with China. So, friends, let's work together to abolish NATO.
And then I want to bring up one other thing that Joseph mentioned, and that, no, it was Ludo on nuclear weapons. Right now we have two women in prison in Germany because they dared go out onto the runway at Buchel Air Base, or was it Vogel? Buchel? Buchel, Germany. They went out, they cut a little fence, walked out onto the runway, and they are now in prison. So if you want to write them, please, in solidarity, go to Nuclear Resistor, and they've got all of the details for that. Third thing I want to mention before we go on to this little presentation is I'm part of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, and we had Montaz that was here talking a little about Gaza. He didn't mention that 120 members of his family have been killed in Gaza. 120 members of his own family have been killed. We have the Gaza Freedom Flotilla that sails. When governments fail, we sail. We have one boat that's right now in Lisbon, Portugal. It's on its way through the Straits of Gibraltar. It'll come into the Mediterranean. It will be sailing toward Gaza. We have three other ships that are in Turkey right now, and we're preparing them to move. We can't tell you where, and we can't tell you when, but they're going to be on the move. So we will continue to challenge the Israeli naval blockade of Gaza for as long as it is there. Okay. So I'm going to talk very quickly about the Pacific area. I live out in Honolulu, Hawaii. Let's have a little aloha. Yeah, aloha, but not for NATO. No, sorry, and not for the Indo-Pacific Command, which is located there, one of the five unified commands the United States has that covers all the way from California all the way to India. That's how far one command goes. And what does it do in that area? Here's some of the presence, and we've talked about parts of this before. from Japan, and particularly Okinawa, South Korea, the largest military base outside the continental United States is Camp Humphreys in South Korea. We have Guam, the militarized tiny little territory of the United States of Guam that is being just smashed by the military. We now have 9 military bases in the Philippines after they were done away with 25 years ago. Now we have 9 of them. We've got them all over the place. We look to how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of U.S. military and civilians are just out in the Pacific area. 375,000 military. We have 200 ships that are there. Just the Navy has 1,000 aircraft, 130,000 sailors. We've got Marines out the Gazoo. We've got the Air Force. Yes, they do have aircraft, but actually not as many as the Marines. 420 aircraft with the Air Force. We've got the Army that has 106,000 people that are a part of it, Special Operations Forces, and then civilians that work for the military, U.S. military in the Pacific Command, nearly 40,000 of them. We're awash in alliances. Alliances now we have between Russia and North Korea. We now have alliances, South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, Thailand, Australia, New Zealand, all new treaty allies of the United States. We've got a specific one now for the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. We've got AUKUS that was mentioned earlier with Australia, the U.S., the U.K., and it's primarily so the U.S. can sell some nuclear submarines. Yeah. We have $8 billion that's now a part of the Taiwan Relations Act. We are selling all sorts of stuff to Taiwan, $360 million just this last month, so they can acquire 1,000 drones. This is what the U.S. Admiral of the Pacific Command is saying. This is going to be the first line of defense for Taiwan if China decides to invade Taiwan. 1,000 drones are going to go up in the air, and then the U.S. is going to have time to come in behind to save Taiwan. I want to turn the Taiwan Straits into unmanned hellscape using classified capabilities, Paparo says. We have stuff going on little islands that you don't even know about. I know about them because for 2 years, I was a U.S. diplomat out in Micronesia. And so I know the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas and Saipan. That's where Julian Assange flew into, finally saw one U.S. judge who didn't screw up the system in terms of keeping him there, but just said, yes, you're free to go out of here. Get out of here. The Northern Marianas, not for doing that, but the United States is having nearly $400 million going into the tiny little area of the Northern Marianas, and that's primarily because Tinian, the island of Tinian, from where the U.S. aircraft went from in World War II, they were carrying the atomic bombs that landed on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These same airfields that haven't been used since World War II are now being renovated. What for? Guam, tiny little Guam, $4 billion of military infrastructure going in there. The newest marine base in the world, first one in 50 years, is now on Guam. The tiny little island of Palau, scuba diver's paradise, now has a new runway, $121 million. And where I was in the Federated States of Micronesia, little tiny islands, 600 little islands all over the place, they are now putting nearly $440 million worth of military infrastructure in it. So here's just a rundown. Guam, 71 military construction projects. That little island is now becoming probably the most militarized island in the world. And mainly because the island of Okinawa has had such good civil protest against all of the crap the U.S. military has been doing in Okinawa for the last 75 years, to include the sexual assault of a lot of women and girls in Okinawa. The civil protests have forced the United States to remove a lot of the Marines that are there, but guess where they're going? Guam. Poor little Guam's taking that. So there, all sorts of stuff's happening there. Hawaii, where I live, Pearl Harbor has a huge, huge military construction project in Pearl Harbor for new docking areas for all of these ships that are coming in. We've heard a little bit about the various military exercises that are going on all over the Pacific, and here's just one of them with the Philippines. But we have U.S. military armadas always out in the Western Pacific that are doing what are called freedom of navigation skills. Here's land exercises that we're having with Indonesia. We've got them with Australia. The largest land exercises in the Pacific are usually every other year in Australia. The Russians are now challenging the U.S. in the numbers of naval exercises, naval war games that are going on. Normally, the Russians haven't been having military war games going, but now they just had one in June with 40 ships involved in it, 20 aircraft, all sorts of marine units. So everybody's bucking up all of this war preparation. Right now, off the coast of the islands of Hawaii is the Rim of the Pacific. It's the largest naval exercise war practice in the world. It happens every other year. We now have 29 countries that have brought in 40 ships, 3 submarines, 150 aircraft. We have over 25,000 military from these 29 countries that are on these ships. I went to the very first protest, the very first day of RIMPAC, which was on the 27th of June. And we had our protest out at Pearl Harbor. And here was, right behind us, was the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson that has 50 jets on it, 5,000 people on it. There were 28 other countries that had their ships in there with 40 ships. They are now all out to sea, and they're practicing killing people all over the Pacific. Of the countries, of the 29 countries, we have 9 NATO countries that are out in the Pacific practicing in these wars. Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, UK, Italy, and us. We have the partners, NATO partners, Australia, Japan, and New Zealand. South Korea are part of it. Colombia is a NATO partner. And we have Israel that is a part of this. So NATO is definitely all over the Pacific. And I'll just mention one other thing. We were talking about environmental things. Well, in Hawaii, we've been putting up with the Navy and all of its pollution for years and years. And then it kind of came to a head 3 years ago when 25,000 gallons of fuel got dumped into our aquifer. And so for years now, we've been protesting, knowing that these 20 underground fuel tanks, each one 20 stories tall, that they were leaking. We knew they were, but boy, all hell broke loose, as you can imagine, when 93,000 people's water supply were contaminated by the Navy. Okay, and that's called Red Hill. It is so important that we recognize, and as Tamara said very, very importantly, you know, we need to go to these places. We need a citizen activist to be out there, whether it's going to China, whether it's going to Russia, whether it's going to Iran, where our government says we should not see what's going on. Of course, we have to go do it. So I would just say, no to NATO, yes to peace. No to NATO, yes to peace. No to NATO, yes to peace. Thank you. Okay.